Well, I thought some of you would be interested in some pictures of how South Africa streets used to look. And this isn't that long ago. Some of us can remember these double-decker buses and the fact that there was no litter on the streets. And you could have open areas that were clean and neat. And oh, this is more recent, believe it or not. Yeah, what does this say about New South Africa? And you can see the improvements in transportation. By the way, some Nkandla pictures. This is the famous cattle kraal at Nkandla. It doesn't look like they're looking after it very well. This is the clinic at Nkandla, which hasn't had anything moved into it. And this is the surveillance security room, which they haven't quite organized it yet. But you can see there's some expensive equipment there. You might be interested to know that the South African rand's just strengthened against the dollar since the Constitutional Court's very positive decision, just reminding people that even presidents and parliaments are under the law. And the cost of oil worldwide has gone down, dramatically gone down. So there's absolutely no reason for the price of fuel to have gone up today. No reason at all. And it's worthwhile, this is what the AA put together, showing us that in fact, when you are paying for your petrol, the vast majority of it is actually going to the government in tax. 4.70 is going to the oil companies and everything else, and you're talking about the freight, insurance, cargo, the financing and all that sort of thing. And then you've got the road accident levy fund, which I'm sure is not available, for 1.54, the fuel levy, 2.55. Basically what comes down to, this government makes 48 billion rand a year from the fuel levy. And of course there's the road revenue from road accident fund, 22 billion. So when every time a person buys fuel, I don't know that they realize how much we've been actually robbed, not just by the criminals in the Gulf states, where one out of every three barrels of oil goes to pay for weapons, but also it's a rip-off scheme for governments. It's not, when people think of what's causing poverty in the country, poverty has been caused by inflation, taxation, and corruption. A quarter of the total wealth of Africa is stolen by governments every year, according to the African Union's reports. So that's 25% of the total wealth of Africa stolen by governments through corruption every year. And then you've got taxation of well over 40%, and then you've also got to add inflation. Inflation is stealing everyone's pensions, savings, property, earnings, because in 1982, the rand was 500 times more powerful than it is now. The rand today can buy 1/500. It takes 500 rand today to buy what cost a rand in 1982, according to the gold standard. So we are being stolen from by inflation, corruption, taxation. And yet, the government's able to blame Jan van Riebeck. If you're wanting to know about why we've got a problem in the country and why you need work ethic, you can just imagine what's going to happen when the train reaches here.
Where's that taken?
I don't know, but I don't want to get on that train.
That's what I want to know.
Somebody posted this. South Africa's the only country in the world where 90% of the taxpayers didn't vote for the ruling party. We've got 19 million people in this country on welfare, receiving free handouts from the state. We've got 5 million registered taxpayers, of which 3.2 million gave tax returns, of which 2.3 million actually paid something. So we've got 2.3 million taxpayers and we've got 19 million welfare junkies. Again, something very strange. This is what it looks like when a man who's never worked a day in his life tries to look like a working man. I mean, is this not pitiful? This is absolutely pathetic. One looks at this and this man has no clue how to handle a pick. I mean, this is bad. And then, this is the first family in America. Notice what they've got on their t-shirts? And where they're coming from? The Nesca Guevara, Che Guevara, it's a restaurant there, and all wearing a t-shirt. Brother, who's Che Guevara? He burned books, banned music, hated Negroes, executed homosexuals, and he's loved by the liberal, socialist, progressives. He's adopted as a symbol of hope and freedom. He, by his own estimation, killed thousands of men, women, and children in cold blood. He executed over 4,500 people, at least, documented, including children. Okay, some good news. This is a symbol of hope. This is in Kentucky, close to the Creation Museum. Ken Ham's aunts in Genesis are building a life-size ark to scale. The biblical ark. This is 7 feet high, 7 stories high. It's the size of several football fields. This is one monumental work of faith. And just praise the Lord for... This is going to be a tour, a site, beating Disney World and all this, in my mind. I mean, as Christians, to go to the Creation Museum and the Ark Encounter will be absolutely stupendous. Can you imagine? This is... And this is getting close. They are about to launch it, I think, this July. It's going to be open for the public in July. That is... And it can be seen for... miles around. This is very high up. So praise God for Aunts and Genesis Creation Museum. And you know that we are the local stockers in South Africa for Aunts and Genesis. Import their materials. It's so vital. Now, you may not see leopards, but leopards see you if you're in their territory. And I think it's worthwhile noting these magnificent animals. But just to make an observation of how people aren't too observant, you can just see this, the tour guide here is probably saying, if you look carefully behind those bushes, I think you can see a lion.
Probably say you can see a buck, that's why the lion's looking as well.
You know, if you can get, be observant, but all too often most people cannot see what's right under their nose. But when you're out camping, it's worthwhile knowing that the king sometimes does do an inspection of the shower facilities. And these magnificent animals, they are really the kings, and these are the princes and princesses in training. Now, is that not a regal family? They look better than any royal family picture. As we're going to look at some horrible things, thought we'd have some nice things to look at too. Tracts. We've been bringing out a whole lot of new tracts, and these can be downloaded electronically too, but you don't have to download them electronically if you're here, because we've got them in the hallway. And help yourself. One of our new booklets we've brought out, Biblical Faith in Modern Counterfeits, is dealing with this issue of so much what people talk about as faith is nothing to do with biblical faith. It's wishing upon a star, wishful thinking, Hollywood sort of nonsense, which is not biblical faith. Biblical faith is bold and brave, and it has boots on. Faith and action always go together. And we've produced our Putting Feature Faith book, one of our old bestsellers back from 1998, redone completely this year, and that's going out with our team. We've got team in the field, and is one of the key books for our discipleship seminars. And the Grace Center Missions is back from the printer, and thank you very much, Avril, for helping with the proofreading of that. This was one of our bestsellers back in 2002, 6,000 copies. We were out for a long time. Now we've got orders for 6,000, or is it 9,000, up in East Africa by SAM, and so we had to redo the whole thing. And it's wonderful having my daughter Daniela to do the artwork. So we were able to bring out a whole new, completely revised and expanded version of the Greatest Century of Missions. We need examples of excellence. We're getting nothing but immoral and substandard role models being lifted up by the media, like Che Guevara, Steve Biko, Nelson Mandela, and so on. We need some examples of real excellence. And our long-standing project, 3 years in the making, Old Testament Survey, is out. And I must say, as I studied through over the last 3 years, I could only resonate with this message. The more I read through the Bible, the less I have in common with modern Christianity. And that Christianity should be in italics with quote marks around it with a small c. Because I must say, studying book by book through the Old Testament has shocked me in many ways as to just how unbiblical most of our churches have become. And how many unbiblical things we've just come to accept. And it's changed a lot of what I thought. Just taking, for example, Leviticus. Leviticus, God is extremely specific as to how he wants to be approached and how he wants to be worshipped. Not just any old how, the way we feel like it, modeling us on some seeker-friendly Hollywood kind of theme park or almost a nightclub in some places. When you think of what happened to those priests, the sons of Aaron, who were struck dead for offering strange fire before God, God is not impressed with our modern type of ways of doing things. A lukewarm message may draw many people to your entertainment-driven church, but it'll never draw people to the uncompromised Christ. And this, unfortunately, is not an unrealistic picture of a lot of what's going on. A lot of people are coming into church, but there's no foundation, and many are falling away. And that's why ministries like Way of the Master, Answers in Genesis, absolutely vital. We've got to know our foundations. And most people don't know their foundations. They don't know their Bibles very well. So it's quite shocking. You know this is true, because if you speak to ministries on campus, Taryn, what's the statistic, the amount of people who church goes who drop out of being involved in any kind of church activities?
75%.
It's estimated 75% of church-going young people drop out of involvement in church after going to university. That is just staggering. That's, if that happened to an army, that wouldn't be a defeat. That would be a massacre. We are not preparing young people for what they're facing in universities. They don't know how to answer skeptics. They don't know how to answer and articulate what they believe and why they believe it. And they certainly, most of them aren't involved in trying to win other people to Christ, because estimates, again, is that there's only 2% of Christians, of churchgoers, are involved in any form of regular evangelism. 2%. It's staggering. We've got so much going for us, and yet we're just losing it by not evangelizing, not praying, not discipling. There's so many things that are being lost. So obviously this is important, getting people back into the Bible. Of course, this is the first part. It's taken 3 years to go through the Old Testament, take about 2 years to go through the New, if we go on the same pace of one book a month. And this will ultimately end up in one book too. But this is already a 280-page book, so that's quite enough to work on for the time being. We've added quite a lot to it. Interesting how people say that God's law is so oppressive, but have you noticed how many tens of thousands of laws man makes? God gave us 10 commandments, and man gives us tens of thousands of laws. God requires 10%, and how much the governments want to steal from you in taxation? Okay, well, that's by way of background. This week has marked a lot of anniversaries, and tonight we're going to be looking at the Holocaust in London, what we can learn from that from 22 years ago. But I should also say that 34 years ago, Frontline Fellowship was launched into Mozambique. Our first mission field was Mozambique. And I never saw it as a tourist destination, but people who were older than me used to speak about Byra, LM, Lorenzo Marx, Prawns, LM Radio, and 500,000 South Africans and Rhodesians used to go to Mozambique every year for tourism, which ended immediately that the communists took over. This was part of Portuguese East Africa, Portuguese West Africa. The Portuguese didn't call these colonies, they were their overseas possessions. In fact, when you drove into Mozambique, I even saw, when I went in 1982, big sign saying Portugal, East Africa. And so it was, you weren't coming to Mozambique, you were coming to Portugal, and the province of Portugal that's called Mozambique, just Portuguese East Africa. And the Portuguese treated it as part of metropolitan Portugal, interestingly enough. But I could not imagine it being a tourist attraction. But these are some pictures. It used to be a beautiful, tree-lined, lovely place. And the Portuguese had quite a long tradition. They'd been there 480-odd years in Mozambique. And they fought a long war against the communists, the terrorists who were trying to destroy Portuguese East and West Africa with a long terrorist war. It started in 1961. When Filimo hacked the head off some priest in Mozambique and desecrated the altar with it, and this was the launching of Filimo's war of terrorism in Mozambique. They lost everything. They never won a battle, but nevertheless, while the Portuguese fought long and hard, and they won their battles on the ground, they were betrayed by their own government. there was a revolution back in Portugal in 1974, and without a referendum, without an election, they just handed over to Frelimo in Mozambique and MPLA in Angola. There was no opportunity for the people on the ground in Mozambique and Angola to choose their future. It was absolutely disgraceful. Where this explorer's statue stood, there's today an idol of our dear Samora Machel. This is what Maputo used to look like, Palana Hotel. This is what it used to look like in Beira at the swimming pool. And now just look at those trees. Look at the progress. You see, that's under the Portuguese evil colonial oppression. And this is liberation. You see the trees just 10 years later. That is progress. The Grand Hotel in Beira, back under the evil Portuguese rule, and the Grand Hotel Beira liberated by the communists. Progress. That was my first mission field, 1982, Easter 1982, heading into Mozambique, although there was no warnings when bridge out, which would have been nice to know. But I fortunately stopped in time. Everywhere we saw communist slogans, clenched fists, red stars, Viva Marxism-Leninism. This, by the way, is the university. So you can see they majored in the same kind of subjects as University of Cape Town and Wits. And Samora Machel was the dictator at the time. He had come to power by assassinating the founder, Eduardo Mondlane, of Frelimo. Eduardo Mondlane was the head of Frelimo. Samora Machel was a nothing. And he came out of nowhere and suddenly became the head of Frelimo just before the Portuguese had the revolution and enabled him to get the country. So this man was a cannibal who ate human flesh in public witchcraft ceremonies. He murdered his first wife. He murdered his third wife's first baby because he didn't think he was the father. And his widow, by the way, became Nelson Mandela's third wife. Both of them had gone through three marriages to get to one another too. They called Mozambique a developing country. Well, anything developing was the rust and the weeds. There were thousands of kilometers of railway in Portuguese East Africa. Nothing was working after a few years of Frelimo. The towns were socialized. The factories were nationalized. Landmines became the national plant. Missionaries had to design new kinds of bicycles, tricycles, really, with hand pedaled, because what do you provide for people who've lost their feet due to landmines? I took this picture of Russian ships taking food out of the country. Now, they came in heavily laden, low in the water, offloaded tanks, trucks, helicopter gunships, weapons. But they went out also low and heavy in the water. So what did this poverty-stricken, starving country have to export? Food. A green country with palm fronds and pineapples and bananas, people were dying of starvation. Absolutely starving to death. These children died within the week of us taking this picture. We took them vitamin-rich milk and so on, it was just too late though. A million people died in what the BBC called Africa's Forgotten Famine. Now this is a green country that used to export food, and exports food now. Cannibalism came back. When you see a fireplace and broken up human skeleton, you know cannibalism is back. 8,000 churches stolen by the government, closed, barred, bolted, burned, bombed out. 8,000 churches around the country, of which 3,300 Protestant. Churches burned, Bibles burned, people massacred, and I documented that in the Killing Fields of Mozambique book. On this occasion, I was on my way to Chimoio, and I saw this Russian radio station on top of the hill, halfway between Matari and Beira, and I stopped to take a picture, and these Frelimo guards who were guarding the road leading up to the radio station came and threatened me, "No, you can't take pictures." So I asked if I could take a picture of them. They said, "Certainly," and all very happy. I gave them some literature, and then I just moved here and I moved around so I could get the radio station in as well. This chap here used to be a terrorist. He was trained in Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow to be a communist revolutionary, and he was converted to Christ and became one of our friends and allies. By the way, at the time I felt very self-conscious about being so light and blonde, so I dyed my hair brown to try and fit in a bit more. And I wondered how, after years, that I could... nobody was arresting me, and I was getting away with film evangelism, major literature. And I asked this chap, and I said, why is it that nobody's harassing me? I mean, it's obvious I don't come from around here. He said, yes, you obviously aren't Portuguese. They think you're an East German. The East Germans run the secret police.
Sure.
It's true. The East Germans ran the Stasi, and the SNASP secret police. So, okay, interesting. They might have had signs for Fanta and Coca-Cola, but there were none. And by the way, these are Zimbabwe soldiers inside Mozambique. Zimbabweans are murdering people by the tens of thousands in Mozambique. These are the resistance fighters, Renamo, the anti-communist guerrillas, most of them barefoot. Some of them don't have weapons. They were told you must get a weapon from the enemy in the first engagement. Literally sent people to action without weapons. Even the women were fighting. This is Alfonso de la Cama, the head of Renamo. He had been officer fighting for Frelimo, for the communists against the Portuguese, and he says, after the revolution, we realized the revolution has been betrayed. We've exchanged Portuguese colonials for Russian colonies, and the Russians are worse. And so they went back to the bush and started fighting against. And he recruited many of these people who used to be Frelimo soldiers, now they're fighting against Frelimo with captured weapons. The enemy is my quartermaster, 14.5 anti-aircraft guns. Nobody under 18 allowed in the churches at that time. What inspired me to start my work in Mozambique back in 1982 was Operation World, saying there's not a Bible for 1,000 people in Mozambique. And nobody under 18 allowed in the church, the least evangelized country in the Southern Hemisphere. So to reach there and to evangelize in these places, that was our inspiration. When I came to one of these congregations in Beira, Baptist Church, they were setting about one of their members to go out, and they said he must go as a work party to Cuba to work in the sugarcane plantations. The Cubans don't come and burn your country down for free. You have to pay with your food and you pay with your young people. So it was a blood levy. And the pastor said 40% of our church members are in the factories of East Germany and Russia and in Cuba. And I said, that's terrible. He said, no, don't cry for us. We were selfish people. We never evangelized anyone. We never even prayed for anyone else. We did nothing. We're selfish people. God's judging us, and rightly. But now we train all our members to be missionaries. And when the government says he must go to Cuba, or he must go to East Germany, or he must go to Russia, we bring them before the church, we commission them, we set them apart to be our missionary, and we say, take the gospel of Jesus Christ to Cuba. Take the gospel of Jesus Christ to East Germany. Take the gospel of Jesus Christ to Russia. And then the pastor said, how many pastors have the privilege of having 40% of their church members in the foreign mission fields of the world? And the government pays to get them there. And we had some good opportunities leading people to Christ. The problems there were not just communism, but witchcraft. A lot of witchcraft. And many times we had to have people bring forward the witchcraft charms and burning them at the end of outreaches. The schools had nothing. Maybe they had chalkboards, but they normally had no chalk. No books, no pens, pencils, or desks. This is it, sitting on a pole under some grass reed hut. But we took in Bibles, and they said the Bible will be our textbook. In 1989, 6 months after I was married, I got captured along with seven other people, six of the American missionaries. The eight of us were in doing medical work and relief amongst Renamo people in the resistance-controlled areas. We took a wrong turn, and we ended up being captured by the communists, and Russian pilots in MI-8 HIP helicopters like these took us off to, first of all, to Tet, and then all the way down to Mashava, where we were incarcerated in the secret police headquarters, Mashava security prison, and that was a whole story in and of itself. My interrogator came out and said to me, I am the devil. I said, you're not the devil. I said, oh, I'm the devil. I'm not only a Marxist and a Leninist, I'm a Stalinist. I trained in Czechoslovakia. I said, well, I'm a Christian. And he just spat up, I hate Christians. And then he rambled off into, there's no God, and Jesus Christ was the first communist, and the Bible teaches communism, and all Christians must support liberation theology. And I said, this isn't very consistent, because if Christianity is communism, and if Jesus Christ supported communism, then why do you persecute Christians, burn Bibles, and forbid missionaries? And so he went into a long diatribe against Christianity, and so I gave him a lecture on the Reformation. So he gave me a lecture on other communist nonsense and attacked Margaret Thatcher. So I gave a defense of Margaret Thatcher's economic policies, and we rambled against Ronald Reagan. I gave a defense of Ronald Reagan. We discussed the French Revolution. We got to the Renaissance. And I was watching the clock, 6 hours, because they're taking my watch. 6 hours we exchanged history lectures. And at the end, he declared the interview over and sent me back. Now, in that room was a table full of hardware, like a hardware store. There's a armchair with leather straps for arms and legs. There were all kinds of things that looked like dental surgery equipment. There was crocodile clips, electric wires for electrocutions. I mean, we could have spent those 6 hours doing all sorts of other things. Mm-hmm. And so, as I've said to my children and others when they're studying history, if you don't think history is important, you know, history can save you your toenails, your fingernails, your teeth, and a whole lot of other things, and being charged with electricity, because communists like history, and they will gladly argue and discuss history with you, as I was able to with Nelson Mandela when he was president. But when you know your history, it can sometimes save your life. That and a whole lot of other things are in the killing fields of Mozambique, but that's where our mission began. And we saw major answers to prayer in 1986. This is the Soviet Tupolev plane that they donated to Samora Machel for his presidential plane, and they flew him around. They had Russian pilots flying it, and you can go to Mpumalanga and you can see right at the eastern border of South Africa, just within South African border, the wreckage of the Tupolev. It was a controlled descent into ground. The pilot error, here they've got a shrine, they literally called a shrine to commemorate Samora Machel, made up of pieces of the plane and things that were found in the wreckage. And they've got these pipes to commemorate the people who died on the plane. Samora Machel's plane was on its way back from where they'd been meeting with the Zimbabwean and the Zambian dictators to discuss how to take Malawi over and turn it into a communist country. And there were churches praying at that very moment. I know, for example, Pretoria Baptist was that very night, 19th of October 1986, praying that evening for God to stop the persecution of the church in Mozambique. Bill Bathman was driving in Eastern Transvaal at that time and said it was the worst electric thunderstorm he had experienced in his life. He said, as a pilot myself, I wouldn't want to be flying in this weather. And that's the very time that Samora Machel's plane smashed to pieces. There's a man who cursed God, who blasphemed the name of Jesus, who challenged God to strike him dead, who gave God 60 seconds counting out with a stopwatch in Red Star Stadium in Maputo. And 40 days later, he met his maker. And very foolish thing to challenge God. But considering we're in April, it was April 1982 that Frontline launched its first cross-border mission to Mozambique. So that's where our mission was really. Well, we were born in the South African Army Prayer Fellowship, but that's where we launched out and became a cross-border operation.